Well, hello everyone, it's Stuart here, and welcome to our teleseminar on Profit PDQ, which for those in England will definitely know means profit pretty damn quick. How to raise profits quickly without jeopardizing growth or your longer term performance. And amazingly, this is the seventh of our 9-part series this year on accelerating growth. So thanks very much for joining me today. And as ever, whether you're on the phone now, live, or listening to an MP3 download, you're really very welcome. And it's great to have you here. So first things first, this seminar is not about cost cutting. I'm assuming that all of you organizations that manage your costs effectively as it is, and as times have got tougher, you've begun to control them even more tightly. So I don't want to focus on cost cutting as a way to driving profit growth. Second thing to say is at the time of this seminar, which is October 2011, the economic recovery in the UK, as well as that across Europe and the US, is probably at best, you can put it as fragile. And it's still difficult out there. Many companies continue to struggle to grow profits. But that said, the techniques and ideas I want to share with you today aren't just about how you drive growth in a downturn. I think there are ideas that you can use in any economy. And in today's session, over the next 25, 30 minutes, what I'd like to do is cover three things. Firstly, start to talk about how strategy can deliver rapid profit growth. Secondly, to cover the fine art of pricing. And thirdly, start to talk about how do you create a high profit organization and what are the features of a high profit organization. So let's start with strategy and the links between strategy and rapid profit growth. And when I speak to many people, they see strategy as long-term and tactics as short-term. I don't have that distinction at all. Strategy to me isn't necessarily long-term. It's about setting a direction. But once you've set that direction, improvements can be immediate and rapid. And you can have that kind of effect on profit growth with a compelling and focused strategy. Let me just give you a very quick example from a project I did about 18 months ago. I worked with the producer of niche healthcare products, and we looked at their business from various angles, and we found that 85% of the sales of that business were to the major retail chains, but 15% were to independents and independent pharmacies and retailers. As we looked at the profitability of those two different channels, we found that the independent channels, the profit margins there, were a lot lower. So we delved a bit deeper, and it quickly became clear that that business and that channel still had a full-time direct sales force operating right across the UK, even though half of the sales in that channel came from one region, the southeast of England. So as a solution, what we're able to do is keep the team in the southeast, but then for the rest of the country, set up an agreement with a third-party agency and also rely on the company's telesales team. This delivered immediate, significant savings, some of which were taken to the bottom line, and others which were invested in new high-growth initiatives. But the key here, as it is in any strategy work, was to reallocate resources from the areas and activities of the business where the company was struggling to segments of the business where the company was winning. And I think it's likely that in your business, in any business, you'll be able to find something similar. Now, as I implied in that example, critical to this, I think, is finding your 80-20 rules, doing the Pareto analysis. And the Pareto and 80-20, just very quickly, in many companies, what you tend to find is that 80% of the sales comes from 20% of the products, and 80% of the profits come from 20% of the sales. You know, it may not be that precise. It might not be quite 80-20. It might be 70-30. It might be 60-40. It might be 90-10. But in most organizations, you find that you make most of your money for a relatively handful of your activities. And understanding and exploiting this situation is critical to driving rapid profit growth. let me just give you another example from a recent project where I was reviewing the performance of different departments in a general retailer, a UK general retailer. And the retailer had been investing lots of new space in a couple of departments that were delivering relatively low levels of return. But its highest profit department, the department with the highest margins, hadn't had any extra increase in space. The sales weren't as dramatic in that department, but the profit was a lot higher. But it hadn't received the extra space. And even though that department had a relatively low overall share in the market. So by reallocating the space and the range in those stores away from the lower profit departments to this high profit category, again, it led to immediate, significant profit growth. And then now, to my mind, these examples sound obvious, but the financial reports that you'll probably use in your business don't always make these nuances apparent. You often need to look at your business in a different way. So how do you get these insights for action? Let me give you five steps that you can take. The step one is to break your business down into discrete business segments. So no business is a homogeneous entity. It typically comprises of several different businesses. Now, some businesses break this down into divisions or business units, but even when you don't have this, you should still be able to identify discrete business segments. And you need to get down a level below the high-level numbers and into each of the different segments that you have and shine a torch on all of the areas of your business to get a handle on the performance and the real opportunities. So how do you do that? Well, I see a segment occurring, a different business segment will occur, where one of three things happen, at least one of these three things. Firstly, that the products and services you offer are distinctively different. The second is the competitors you face for those products and services are different. And the third would be where the customers you're serving for those products and services are different. Different products and services, different competitors, different customers tell you that this is a different business segment. So the step one to undertaking this analysis and generating these insights is to work out what are the different business segments that you have in your organization. Step two is to identify the sales for each of those segments. And ideally, I would do that for 3 years. By looking at it over 3 years, you start to get an idea of trends rather than one-off events. But it's also kind of reasonably short period of time. And in most organizations, you can collect the data fairly rapidly. If you've only got a year's worth of data, you know, that's still okay, but if you can get 3 years or so worth of data, you can start to see the trends and start to see the patterns a bit more clearly. But what you need to do is to allocate the sales, not how it may be reported in your current profit and loss account, but under each of those business segments that you've produced in step one. That was step two, identify the sales. Step three is to identify the costs for each of those business segments. There are three types of costs that you'll need to look at. One is the cost of sale. So what are the direct costs, the manufactured costs, the bought-in materials costs? And usually sales less cost of sales will give you your gross profit. But then there are two other costs. And because lots of organizations manage to the gross profit level, they'll look at the sales of their products and the gross profit. What this analysis does is take it a stage or two further. The first is you start to allocate your sales, marketing, and distribution costs, and you try and find a way of linking, allocating those costs across your different business segments. Now, one way to do that might be on the basis of sales turnover, but I think we all know that some areas of a business are more costly to run than others. So if you can get a handle on where does your advertising and promotion go, which of your product areas are harder to distribute, more costly to distribute and store? Which ones get most attention in terms of returns or customer service support? If you can do that, then you can start to get a more nuanced picture of where your costs are actually going in your business. The third lot is your general and admin costs. So cost not directly attributable to the development or selling of a product. So that will include things like finance, HR, IT, typically. And again, that would generally be allocated on the basis of sales. So there, for each of your business segments, you start to get a more fine-tuned profit figure. You've gone down from gross margin. You're more at an operating profit level. But then you can do the same for your capital employed, which is step four. So for your capital employed, you can say, where is that capital actually employed? Which of the business segments does it really belong to? Which one? Which business segment takes up which bit of capital? And then you can allocate the depreciation of that capital and any cost of capital you have to, again, each of the different business segments. So at that point, you can then move on to step five and calculate the profitability and the profit growth of each of your business segments over the last 2 or 3 years. And as you do that, you should be asking questions such as, where are we making money at the moment and where are we losing it? Where is our business growing and where are we stagnating or even going backwards? And where are we making acceptable levels of return and where are we falling short? And typically what you see, as I say, is the 80-20 rule happening in practice. So I would encourage you to have a look at your business on this basis. Break down your business into discrete business segments. Identify the sales for each segment, ideally over the past 3 years. Identify the costs for each of those segments, the operating costs. Do the same for your capital employed, and then start to calculate the profitability and the profit growth for each of those business segments. And what you tend to find is that the 80-20 rule starts to happen. Now, I've started by doing this from a product service perspective. What you can also do is look at your business from a customer perspective. So instead of breaking your business down from products and services, you can start to say, can we allocate our sales and our costs across loyal customers or less loyal customers or different demographic splits? Well, you might do it through different sales channels. So the web business might have one P&L, retail another, mail order another P&L again. But the whole idea is to get under the skin of the top level numbers that you usually come across. And the other thing to say here is that this analysis, this kind of 80-20 analysis, is the start of a process. And things aren't always black and white. It's not about switching something. It's not a switch where something goes on and off. It's more of a rheostat where you're shifting emphasis. And so, for example, I was working with a consumer goods business, and we found that about 70% of their profits came from just 3 of their 10 brands. So they had 10 brands, but 3 of them delivered 70% of the profits. But when we looked at their advertising and marketing spend, that was spread quite evenly over those 10 brands. As a result of our analysis, we redistributed the advertising investment into the high potential categories, the stronger brands, and we drove higher growth in those areas. We still kept some of that marketing investment for the lower potential brands, but we switched the dial on the rheostat. We didn't switch it off entirely, but we changed the rheostat. And that's what strategy is all about. It's about focusing your resources where you'll get the biggest returns. And that means sometimes you need to reduce investment in poor performing areas of your business. And 80-20 analysis is a great way to start. So that's kind of 80-20 analysis and how that can help you deliver rapid profit growth. And I would really recommend you doing that for your business. But there are other strategy approaches, what I would call strategy approaches, that you can use as well. Let me just briefly share 3 with you. The first is offering new products and services to existing customers as a way of driving quick and rapid profits. In general, it's easier to sell to existing happy customers than it is to attract new customers. You know, if you think about it, this has been Tesco's strategy in the UK for the last decade or two. It gets satisfied customers, it then introduces them to new categories. So you can start to think, what adjacent categories could your business move into? Not a huge leap, but things that your existing customers might be happy to buy from you. I know I used to work for Boots. And in the 1990s, Boots got into high-end cosmetics. They were able to get the likes of Clinique, brands like Clinique and Estee Lauder, into their stores. They already sold other cosmetics brands, but they put in higher service, higher value cosmetics into the stores. And they are now the UK's largest retailer of high-end cosmetics. They did that by selling to their existing satisfied customers. It's easier to sell, to offer new products and services to existing customers than it is to try and sell existing products to new customers. Apple has taken its core satisfied customers and gone from computers through to music, through to phones. There's talk of them producing a TV. I could see them producing a car in the future. I mean, why not? So again, the question for you is, what about your business? What are the adjacencies that your customers would be happy buying from you? The second area that I would recommend that you looked at would be to, if you're a certain type of business at least, is to replicate proven business models in new geographies. So this is the basis of all retail expansion. So some of my clients, Dunelm, which is a soft furnishings retailer, have driven a lot of growth over the last 4 or 5 years by setting up stores in new towns. DFS, another client of mine, was acquired by a private equity company last year, and part of its growth strategy has been to open new stores in new locations. Now, the key here is to have confidence that the customer needs are similar, so that the customers aren't too different from your existing customers. And Tesco at the moment is struggling in the US because they've underestimated those differences in customer tastes and customer needs. But if you have a proven business model that works in one geography, a great way to grow profits is to take that to similar types of customers in new geographies. The third thing I think you would need to focus on is to clarify what you're famous for and then make more of that. Now, there are five types of competitive leadership. You can be a product leader, such as Apple or BMW. You could be a cost leader, such as Aldi, Ryanair. You could be a convenience leader, like McDonald's and Amazon. You could be a service leader, like John Lewis Partnerships. Or you could be a solutions leader, such as IBM, which is all about customization. Now, you know, as I said, Amazon, for example, is all about convenience. And everything it does is about making its offer, its products, more convenient for its customers. So if you think about the delivery focus that Amazon has, the Kindle, the ability to download, it's all about convenience. Now, this focus helps the business stand out, but it also helps it marshal its resources for maximum effect. It's decided it's a convenience leader, it's not a service leader. And so it doesn't, for example, have people on phones ready to take your order. It doesn't have people on phones ready to provide really great advice about the best products to choose. It has done that, it focuses on convenience. So it doesn't have a service team, but it asks people to write reviews online. It does it in a way where it doesn't have to provide that extra service. It focuses its investments on its area of leadership. And what you typically see with the best companies is that they focus on their area of leadership, whether they're a product, cost, convenience, service, or a solutions leader, and they're willing to pull back investment on the other areas. What I typically find with customers who haven't determined what kind of leader they want to be is that they try and push equally on all five fronts. And that dilutes effort, it dilutes resource, and it dilutes growth. So those three other areas, offering new products and services to existing customers, replicating proven business models in new geographies, and clarifying what you're famous for and then making more of it, are three further ways that you can use strategy to drive rapid profit growth. The second area I wanted to talk about today, I've called the fine art of pricing, because as you know, pricing is as much an art as it is a science. But let me give you just a little bit of accounting background. And that's simply this, that for every 1% you drop your price, all of the things being equal, you will lose 1% on your net margin. So, for example, if you have net profit margins of 5%, so for every £1 of sales you make, you keep 5 pence of profit. If you have 5% profit margins and you lower your prices by 1% but see no volume uplift from that, then your profit margins will fall by about, will fall 1% to about 4%. So this drop in margin from a 1% drop in price equals a 5% to a 4% profit margin, which is a drop in profits of 20% from 5 to 4. It's a drop of 20%. On the other hand, if you raise prices by 1% and see no volume falls, then your margins will grow to approximately 6%, which is a rise of 20%. So for many businesses, and 5% is a typical profit margin, many businesses, a 2% swing in prices can generate up to 40% profit swings. So my point is this, is that pricing is critical. Many managers, executives, pour over their costs to the nth degree, but they don't do the same with pricing. One consequence of that I see is it leads to excessive discounting, giving away too much value to customers. Now, we all need to promote great value, but you don't necessarily want to give your profits away for no good reason. Again, I recently worked with the buying team of a UK retailer, and we looked at the depth of discount on some of its offers, and we found that there's quite a few of the promotions and discounts weren't generating any extra sales, and the business was able to deliver a 5% profit increase by shifting the emphasis of its promotions and discounts and reducing the level of discount. By focusing on pricing, you can have an immediate impact on your overall profitability. And I'm going to share with you 7 ways to improve your focus on pricing. The first, is to put as much, if not more, effort into price management as you do into cost management. I'm talking here about weekly or monthly reviews of pricing, to have sign-off limits for customer discounts, to demand from your managers options for any proposed price decreases. There are many cost accountants out in the world. You often hear there's a cost accountant. I have yet to hear of a price accountant. Maybe they do exist, but I would have more price accountants than I would cost accountants. It has that much impact on your sales and your profitability. So how much effort do you put into price management compared with the effort you put into cost management? Number 2, ensure that you're developing the selling and negotiating skills of your sales teams. Again, how much effort do you put into this? I know of one major consumer goods business, for example, that gives its sales teams about 10 days of development in these areas every year. Every person up to about 10 days a year. Effective negotiating is the cornerstone of effective pricing in business-to-business companies. And if you take training out of other areas of your business in straitened times, then I would still maintain, if not increase, investment in the selling and negotiating skills of your sales teams. That's number 2. Number 3, review your opening price points. Again, I have a client who's kind of quite a retail client that's famous for their value and for the keen prices they offer. And I was talking to the managing director one day about his pricing policy and why he didn't start to think about ratcheting up the prices in some areas. And what he said to me was that, Stuart, if customers think you offer great value at your entry-level price, they are more likely to trade up. But if they don't trust your entry-level prices, they are less likely to trade up or even buy from you. Getting your opening price points at the right level is critical to the success, not just of the sales of those products, but of every other product that you have on offer. When Sir Stuart Rose first took over Marks & Spencer's, one of the first actions he took was to review opening price points for some of the key value lines in that business, and saw an immediate change by shifting emphasis and shifting perception. It's a big perception driver, opening price points. So how competitive are your opening price points is a question I think you need to answer. Number four is to review your promotions and discounts. So as well as your pricing, review your promotions and discounts. And what kind of, if you give away kind of sales, discount heavily, I think you're more likely to grow profits more sustainably if you discount less but offer great value more consistently than if you have very deep but very infrequent discounts. You know, it also makes the management of your supply chain easier, so lowers costs. But how often and how systematically do you review your promotions and discounts? And what I found is even in the most sophisticated retailers I come across, they find it difficult. They don't put that effort into reviewing the performance of their promotions. That's number four. Number five is to unbundle your products and services. You know, you don't have to put everything into a single product or service and charge a single price. So unbundling allows you to offer different prices for similar outcomes, and it allows you to trade people up. So car makers tend to have a model, and they'll have the L version, the GL version, the GLX version, all with different features at different price levels. I mean, airlines offer first class, business class, and economy class. And hotels will offer normal rooms, executive rooms, and suites. You know, this kind of good, better, best approach that you see in these businesses, I think is applicable to all businesses. So you might want to ask yourself, have you unbundled the products and services you offer sufficiently enough? Have you been able to rather than just lowering prices of your products, are you able to have a range of different price points for the same model that allows you to sell, if people want to trade down, they can go down to something, but you're not losing profit because there are fewer features on that model. So some companies, rather than just having this unbundle into kind of mini bundles, this good, better, best approach, some companies allow you to take a menu, an a la carte approach. So Dell, when you buy a Dell computer, certainly online or over the phone, you can dictate exactly which of the features you want and which you don't want. And Ryanair, our favorite airline, you pay a fee for the, basically to get a seat on the flight, but everything else you pay for as you go along. So food, baggage, even checking in, you pay for. So the question is, how much further could you unbundle your products and services so that you can better manage prices and better avoid unnecessary discounts? Number six, are lower spec discount ranges, offering lower spec discount ranges. So especially in these more difficult times, and particularly for more value-conscious customers, you might need, it's certainly better that you cannibalize your sales than your competitors do it for you. So Tesco, for example, a couple of years ago, introduced their discounter range to try and limit the impact that Aldi and Lidl were having on their business. But it's not just in the straitened times that you do that. Holiday Inn has Holiday Inn Express. Same brand, but for customers who aren't willing to pay for a full hotel service. Even Giorgio Armani has an Armani Jeans sub-brand that enables its customers to stay with the business rather than moving to alternative providers. So again, is there an opportunity for a discount range or a lower level brand that your business could introduce? Number seven in our list of seven is looking to increase prices. Obviously, the best way to increase prices is to offer more value. But I think the truth is that some products and services are more sensitive to price than others. And so as well as looking certainly in these kind of difficult economic times at where you might need to lower prices, you should be asking your team and asking yourself what the opportunities are for price increases in your business, where they may be. And often they are on the accessories side of your product rather than the core product. So those are seven steps on the fine art of pricing. Put as much, if not more, effort into price management as you do into cost management. Ensure you're developing the selling and negotiating skills of your sales teams. Review opening price points. Review promotions and discounts. Unbundle your products and services. develop and offer lower spec discount ranges, and 7, look for opportunities to increase prices. The third area I briefly like to touch on is really, what does a high profit organization actually look like? So what are these companies that can generate high profits? So across various markets, I see a certain set of characteristics about higher performing, higher profit organizations than in the lower performing, lower profit organizations. So they may be in different markets, different industries, but some of their organizational approaches and ways of working are common. I'm going to give you 12 of them very briefly. Here we go. First one is that they have crystal clear objectives. These businesses and managers know what's important. They've set clear goals for the organization. They've made trade-offs. They've agreed priorities. They've determined what they're not going to do as well as what they are going to do. They know what's important, what they're focusing on. They have crystal clear objectives. Number 2, they play to their strengths. This is the essence of what we've been talking about under strategy, is investing where they're advantaged. Yes, they add to their capabilities, but they never try to go somewhere where they can't compete effectively. They play to their strengths. Number 3, they have clear accountabilities. They don't have people tripping up over themselves and each other, working out who's responsible for what. Each individual in that organization knows what results they're accountable for, which leads me on to number 4, is that they are held to account. High-profit organizations don't just plan, they manage performance effectively. They deal up front with poor-performing teams, poor-performing projects, and poor-performing individuals. And they use that as a way to improve performance. Number 5, high-profit organizations get close to their customers. So even A.G. Lafley, who was the ex-CEO of the giant consumer goods business Procter & Gamble, even he spent at least 2 days a quarter directly with consumers of that business. How often are you spending time with your customers? High-profit organizations get as close to their customers as they can so that they really understand the issues they're facing. Number 6, outsource non-critical activities. And the high-profit organizations don't try to do everything, but they focus on where they're advantaged and outsource other activities. So, for example, one of my clients, which manufactures household goods, has decided to get out of manufacturing itself, because it realized the area of its advantage was on product development, not on manufacturing. It's got out of manufacturing, and it's so that it could increase its focus on its area of expertise. Number 7, high-profit organizations partner. I think partnership is an increasingly important skill and capability that any organization needs to have to compete effectively and to grow effectively as a business. So that means working with suppliers, customers, and others, integrating them into their operations, but also about developing new products and services. It used to be that it was really the high-tech world where partnerships, where Sony Ericsson on phones, where these partnerships would happen. But see it now in virtually every industry. I'm working with a couple of organizations at the moment working across those two businesses to identify a joint opportunity for new product and service development that they could bring to the market. What partnerships are you working on at the moment? Who are your partners that you're actively seeking to grow your business with? I think partnership's a critical skill that you should have. Number 8 is high-profit organizations focus on cross-business relationships. I may have said this before, but your ability to get anything done is directly proportional to the size and quality of your relationships with your colleagues and your stakeholders. You can't get anything done yourself, so the better your relationships you have with others, the more you will get done. At Pixar, the MD said that everyone must have the freedom to communicate with anyone. Everyone in that organization must have the freedom to communicate with anyone. Of course, that works two ways. That means anyone has the freedom to communicate with you, to provide feedback and challenge to you. And it's that ability to challenge, to provide feedback, to communicate, that helps you overcome the kind of the inevitable issues that you face. Number nine, high profit organizations don't have a fear of failure. They are willing to take prudent risks and try things. They will manage the risks, yes, but they are not fearful of failure. Linked to that, number 10, they are persistent. They remain fixed on the vision. They stick to their strategic goals. Even if the initial projects don't work, they might change the way they try and achieve those goals, but they are persistent. Number 11, high-profit organizations have a much higher degree of simplicity. Organizational complexity, I think, is the enemy of pace, and therefore it's the enemy of growth. And high-profit organizations keep their ways of working as simple as they possibly can. And when they're faced with a choice, they always err on the side of simplicity. And number 12, high-profit organizations quickly get behind winners. If they see something's working, they refocus, they change the plans to make the most of it. They pounce on what's working and make even more from it. So those are the 12 areas of a high profit organization. Crystal clear objectives, playing to their strengths, clear accountabilities, holding teams and people to account, getting close to customers, outsourcing where you're not advantaged, being a great partner, focusing on cross-business relationships, having no fear of failure, being persistent, erring on the side of simplicity, and quickly jumping on winners. So as I say in this call, what I've tried to set out is that rapid profit growth is not about cost cutting. It's about understanding how you can focus your critical resources where you're advantaged and where you can deliver the best possible returns. It's about pricing accordingly and then organizing effectively to make that happen as quickly as possible. It's important to be lean, but you can't cut your way to growth. So, I hope you enjoyed that session. I hope you got some actions that you can take away from today's seminar. I wish you the very best of luck in focusing your strategy where it most adds value and in delivering the rapid revenue and profit goals for your business. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I look forward to speaking with you again next month. Goodbye.